I will call to order the February 4th meeting of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. And before us today, we will have four administrative bills that are technical corrections and other housekeeping details. And we'll have the various plan directors available today to go through those for members of the commission. And we are just short a few members to have a quorum, and we will endeavor to take action on the non-controversial administrative provisions today as we start to build the omnibus bill for 2016. The other order of business that was presented and carried over yesterday to today because of the quorum issue would be LCPR 16-012, which deals with the assumptions that we had discussed and previously and are just pending action by the full commission. So with that, I would like to invite Mr. Bergstrom from MSRS to come forward and tell us about the administrative changes that they are proposing, and that will be file LCPR 16-001. Mr. Bergstrom, good morning and welcome back to the commission.
Mr. Chair, good morning. Thanks for having me. What I'd like to do is turn this over to Chad Burkett. He is a member of our staff, and he helped put together this bill, so I'd like to turn it over to him to explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. Mr. Burkett, welcome to the commission, and if you'd state your name for the record, and then proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, good morning. My name is Chad Burkett. I'm the legislative liaison at the Minnesota State Retirement System. I'm just going to be summarizing the...
Mr. Burkett, I'm just going to ask you to pull the mic just a little bit closer to you because we're not catching you there.
Is that better?
I think so. Okay. Members? Okay. Proceed.
So with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'll just summarize the administrative bill and then stand for any questions. I'd like to start by thanking the administrative staff for the commission and their help for putting together a bill that I think you'll find is administrative in nature and fairly common sense. I'll just start with sections 1, 6 through 8 and section 23, which all do the same thing. And that's just clean up a section that refers to repayment of refunds when someone takes a refund after they separate from service and come back to service, they can buy that time that they took a refund for back. And this just takes, we have a few different provisions in place, a few different procedures in place for buying that back. This will just clarify them all and unify them so they're the same procedure for all the plans. Section 2 was requested by Minnesota Management and Budget. So after last year, we put in an ongoing and open appropriation for the legislators' plan. They just requested that we put this change in to make it clear that they can take funds from the state's general fund and apply them to the state's legislators' plan. Section 3 creates an exception for defined contribution plans at MSRS so that the transactions within the plan don't have to take place within the state's SWIFT accounting system. Basically, the SWIFT accounting system isn't designed for the type of transaction, the number that occur in our defined contribution plans. We have hundreds of thousands of transactions that occur within those plans every day. We do have a contract with a record keeper that does keep track of all those transactions for us. They do a very good job. MMB has no objections to that provision. Sections 4 and 5 deal with the MSRS executive director and deputy director. So it changes the language that the executive director qualifications for the executive director position at MSRS. As you may know, Mr. Bergstrom is getting ready to retire and at the end of this year, and the board is just looking at some succession planning issues, and they wanted to broaden the scope of what they're able to hire, the definition for the position that they're able to hire for. That also allows them to the executive director to hire a deputy director. The remaining sections apply to all the plans, not just MSRS, because they're in the 356 section of the statute. So section 9 deals with the combined service annuity section. and there was just some language in there that made it unclear how deferred augmentation rates should be applied. It was unclear if the language was applying to deferred augmentation rates or the plan's formula rates. This just clarifies that for staff. Sections 10 through 22 is really the bulk of the bill, and it deals with the appeals procedures for MSRS, TRA, and PARA. And basically, we had a set of procedures in place previously that, or currently, that were a little bit confusing for both staff and our members. We think this the new appeals procedures language really clarifies that considerably for our staff and members. And if, I'll go ahead and just give you an overview of what the appeals procedure looks like. And this isn't really a big deviation from what we're currently doing. It just makes it easier for everyone to understand, I think. So basically now when a member gets a determination from staff on something like a pension benefit or eligibility, if they disagree with the determination from staff, they can appeal to the executive director, and the executive director then has the opportunity to overturn or modify or affirm the decision from the staff member. If the member is still not satisfied with that, they can petition for review from the governing board, and the executive director can then either send the case to a fact-finding conference or can go straight to the governing board. If it goes to the governing board has a couple of options there as well, to send it back to a fact-finding conference if that wasn't done previously, or send it to a contested case hearing. And both of those contested case hearing and fact-finding conferences are done by an administrative law judge. And then the administrative law judge makes a recommendation to the governing board as to whether or not how to rule, basically. And the board, though, still has the ability to rule as they see fit in accordance to what they understand the law is. If the member is still not satisfied after the board's decision, they would then appeal to the Court of Appeals. So that concludes my summary. Mr. Chair, if there's any questions.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Lincheski, you had a chance to review the MSRS administrative proposal, administrative bill changes, and put together a summary for the commission. Is there comments or thoughts that you'd like to share with the commission at this time before we open it up to questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I don't have any additional comments except to say that we did collaborate real closely with Dave and Chad at MSRS in making sure that there were actual, you know, real improvements to the language, and also in some cases we, I think, reduced the request so that there were really some essential changes, and I think improved the statutes considerably.
Thank you. Members' questions for folks. Representative Murphy followed by Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burkett, or maybe Ms. Lincheski, this clarifying the procedures for appeals, would that cut down because it's clarifying and people would understand better, or there would be this fact-finding board? Would that cut down on the number of individual bills that the Pension Commission hears?
Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I doubt it, frankly. I think what we see here at the Commission, of course, this is my first year, so I'm not entirely clear on what all is the scope of that, but I believe what we typically have here that we hear at the Commission are changes to the statute. So where there's a challenge of a benefit calculation or something like that, that typically wouldn't come here for statutory activities. So I don't think it will change the types of claims that are being brought under the claims procedure or reduce that or really have much of an impact on the Commission's business. But I think what it may do is that now the procedures are much clearer, so potentially there could be more people feeling that they understand and then would want to access those procedures and potentially more claims for the plan. But I don't think that will change what we do here.
Representative Berkey, follow-up.
It was just a thought, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Berkey, did you want to share any your experience with public clarifications and proposed legislation would help expedite processes and provide clarity to Representative Murphy's question?
Well, Mr. Chair, to Representative Murphy's question, I agree with Ms. Linshetsky that the probably won't affect the individual bills that we see here much. I think that it is going to offer a lot of clarity to members as to how to access the appeals process. At least some clarity to members as to how to access the appeals process. The other advantage is that it creates an easy to understand for the staff of the pension funds so that they're administering the appeals procedures in the same way for all of the funds. So.
And Representative Murphy, we do have many of those coming to us later on in the session, too.
That's
you
what I understand, Mr. Chair, on the 25th, right?
Yes, we've put a little schedule together to try to be able to pull it together, and we do have at least six or eight of them that I know of that are in the hopper at this point. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Ms. Linshetsky also. Under the proposed 001 that we're reviewing, under refund, and this is in regard to legislators, refunds, has this been in, I'm trying to understand, let's see, if a former member returns, like I did, we've had the ability to reinstate, is that correct? And now with that language on line 2.2, repayment is provided, and then under our retirement fund in paragraph C, that looks like new language. So could you clarify? I know it says in the narrative that these are clarifications, but what is different about the refund under subdivision 2 as well as section 2 legislators retirement fund?
Ms. Linshetsky, before you answer that, I'm going to just add something that I think will also help clarify that. We have two different plans that legislators are eligible for, the pre-1997 plan and the post-1977 plan. So my assumption is going to be that the post-1997 plan is going to be handled as any kind of deferred comp which the individual could take, and that would just come out. I think we would be referring to those legislators who would take out of the pre-1997 plan. If they would return, would end up having. That's my hunch, but I'm going to get verification on that. Ms. Linshetsky?
Yeah, that's a good point. Go ahead.
You know, actually, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson. My understanding is that this is all clarification, so I don't think it changes anything substantively as far as the rights to repay a prior refund. But I would like to get confirmation from MSRS on that point, if that would be all right.
That's good. Yes.
Either of you gentlemen want to expound on that for us?
Sure, Mr. Chair. It doesn't change the rights to buy back into the plan in any way. It changes stuff actually. So after you separate from service, it changes the amount of time that you would have had available to buy it back. It actually extends it to 6 months. I have to look here for a second if there's any other changes, but I think that's the main change it makes. It also, for the legislature plan, that's the only change that it makes.
But Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burkett, it doesn't apply to those of us who are in the plan that was in effect I believe it kicked in July of 97 and ongoing, you know, so we're in a plan different from those who were elected prior to that time. I don't think it applies to our plan, though, does it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, it doesn't apply to the unclassified plan that way. That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
My understanding would be it would be handled no different than any other kind of deferred comp because it's not tied to a defined benefit, it's a defined contribution.
Yes.
And under IRS regulations, they grow into an IRA or segregated and separated from them.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. That,
yep. Any other questions for the testifiers or on the MSRS proposed administrative changes? Gentlemen, thank you. And we will ask Mr. Anderson from PERA to come forward with his bill. and we're still just short of a quorum, but we will endeavor to try to take action on these today. So keep those handy, members, if you would. Mr. Anderson, welcome once again to the commission, and we'll be taking a look at your proposal, which is going to be, for our reference, LCPR 16-003. So, again, that's LCPR 16-003. Mr. Anderson, if you would state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, and that's the TRA bill.
I think we want 002.
002.
I think they were just clipped together, Mr. Chair. I believe they were just clipped together incorrectly. So the parabell was attached to the TRA memo. And so just
Mr. Anderson, what would you like to talk to us about today? Maybe we could start there.
Okay,
so I'm going to just switch covers here, it looks like. Give us just one moment.
Just to confuse.
No worries. All right, so if you look in the upper right-hand corner of the bill, you'll see 00-13, and it was just crisscrossed. So I'm assuming that everybody's found the appropriate memo, and 003, excuse me. Yep. Okay. Now let's try that again. Welcome, Mr. Anderson. If you'll proceed, state your name for the record.
My name is Doug Anderson. I'm Executive Director of PARA, and I'm going to turn our presentation over to Julie Lepping, our Legal Director.
Ms. Lovick, welcome, and for the record, please state your name and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Julie Lepping, Legal Director for PERA and actually also for MSRS, but I'm here on behalf of PERA today. The PARA administrative bill proposes a number of changes, but the changes are minor. They bring our statute into conformity with our practice as it stands, or clarifies language or repeals obsolete language. And I do want to echo Mr. Burkett's comments that we worked closely with LCPR staff, and it was an excellent experience to hammer out these changes, and we very much appreciate that. I'll go through section by section and just with a brief summary. Section 1 is service and salary credit purchases. And we streamlined this process for purchases in an earlier session by changing descriptors of leaves to just really treat leaves all the same. And this takes that one step further by making clear that when you make a purchase, you're purchasing both service and salary credit instead of having two separate statutes. So this section adds language to the service credit purchase, and as you can see under Section 6, repeals the obsolete language. So everything will remain in the same section. Regarding Section 2, refunds after death, and actually Section 3 as well. This makes clear that if someone dies before receiving their annuity, but they've received a disability benefit or another type of benefit, the amounts of those benefits would be deducted from a potential refund. And that's the case if someone has... that's already the case. There's existing language, and in Section 3, we clarify that the same thing will happen if you've taken a refund. So essentially, if you've taken money out of the plan, it should be reflected by a reduced amount of a potential refund. In Section 4, this has to do with PARA Police and Fire membership for Hennepin County Medical Center supervisors. They are qualified who are qualified as paramedics and emergency medical technicians. Those groups are already included, but we did have a question come up about whether the supervisors were included, and this clarifies the language that, yes, they are included in the plan. Section 5 references a combined service annuity. This codifies current practice that you must terminate service in all plans to receive a benefit. And finally, Section 6, again, I said, is a repeal because we've combined service and salary credit into Section 0162. Mr. Chair, you or the commission have questions?
Members, questions for the matter before us on the ERA administrative correction bill? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do find it interesting that there's been a practice going on, but it's not been per the statute. How does this happen, that these decisions are made, but it's not really in statute that this is allowable? How has that happened?
Ms. Lynchowski.
Thank you, Representative Erickson, Mr. Chair. It is extremely common for there to be interpretations that are done by the plan, by the plan administration, in order to address unique situations or situations that come up and are not explicitly addressed by the statute. So, I mean, I'm drawing from my private sector experience as well. There is not a plan in the U.S. that operates 100% in conformity with this plan documentation. So there is this leeway, though, that's given to interpret the provisions, to apply it, and make sure that that you're able to address all the situations that come in. So I think it is the fact that you could have interpreted these statutes to cover what it is covering, but now we're being a little bit clearer and making sure that the statute, in fact, does address the specific situation. Julie, I think if Julie would like to add anything to that, that would be helpful, too.
Mr. Chair, that is correct, and there are several provisions. Really, these changes, for example, the combined service provision, the language says now, or the person has made application for benefits for each applicable plan. Well, to the plan administrators, that means you can't apply for benefit till you've terminated. But to one of our members reading that, they may not realize it from that language. So we said before that they have to terminate all service, it makes it clear. Similarly, I think our plan, looking at the supervisors from Hennepin County, for example, they have the same qualifications as the EMTs that they supervise, but it wasn't crystal clear, and a question came up, so we added it so we know for certain, and so that they know for certain. So none of what we've been doing so far is inconsistent with the statute. It may be an interpretation. We want to be clear so that anyone reading it knows the statutes that bind them or govern them.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Lynchowski, does that mean there was ambiguity when we designed these statutes like there often is in many statutes? And so now it's going to be a little more specific, and then in the future we might need another correction because we still didn't reach the 100th percent of non-ambiguity.
Ms. Lynchowski.
Thank you, Representative Erickson and Mr. Chair. I would have to tell you, I think that is the way this would go. We are continuing to fine-tune and fine-tune. Unfortunately, there's so many variations on these themes. So I think we're getting closer, and we'll continue to work on that. But unfortunately, it probably doesn't mean you don't have to deal with this again sometime down the road. But I think we're closer.
Well, Mr. Chair and Ms. Lynchowski, it is interesting, though, that you've said that in private plans there's also sometimes ambiguity, so that is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Other questions on the matter before us, the PERA corrections bill, administrative bill? I'm going to ask the two of you to stay close by, and I'm also going to give a heads up to Mr. Bergstrom. Since we've had two bills, I do want to make sure the public has a chance to testify. Since there's a total of four, this seems like a pretty good spot to be able to allow people who might have questions or want to testify in the MSRS or the PERA bills that are before the commission today. Is there anyone from the public who would like to provide comment today to the commission on either the MSRS or PERA proposals before us for administrative correction? Seeing none and hearing, sir, please proceed.
I have some handouts I'd like to provide, if I may, Chair, to the members as well as this meeting. Would that be possible?
Well, sir, right now we are on two pieces of bills that are before us. That's not necessarily a matter that we have, unless the handouts you have are related to the two bills that we are talking about right now, which is the MSRS Administrative Corrections Bill, and the second would be that of the PERA Corrections Administrative Corrections Bill. If you have other supplemental materials that you'd like to have the commission receive that's not on this matter, if you want to hand that to Lisa, and then she can pass it out. But the two matters that we're on right now are the ones that I just mentioned.
I can defer to the end of the meeting, perhaps, if you allow me to speak.
However, I know you've testified many times at the legislature, so you know that you do also need to identify yourself for the record. So I'm just going to ask you to take a moment to do that as well.
My name is Rick Keller. I unofficially represent the twice exceptional and print disabled. I'm testing to the Legislation Commission on Pension and Retirement on February 4th, 2016. I'm not quite sure this is relevant, but I expressed yesterday at the meeting regarding content accessibility, regarding your bills, for instance. I'm not quite absolutely sure if this bill is in draft form or if it was presented on the floor from last year. But I think you find interesting the correspondence in the very back of my handout from Jason. He's the revisor for the legislature about the accessibility for the public regarding these PDFs versus HTML formats, about making them fully accessible. So I don't know if that's relevant to the discussion. However, if you don't provide appropriate access for the audience that this is intended for, I think it's very relevant for open meeting law, as well as these meetings have not been posted on the outside of the door of room 200. I think that's a requirement at the legislature as well. And it's the responsibility of the LCC or the members of this committee or someone, maybe the Sergeant of Arms. But to have an open forum, I believe you do, it needs to meet some of those requirements. So if you would like me to proceed with these documents I had, and I'd like to explain briefly, maybe not about this bill, but accessibility at the end, if you're willing to entertain that discussion for the public forum.
Well, sir, thank you for your comments today, and you were with us a little less than 24 hours ago as well, sharing the same information. And obviously, we weren't able to get all of the issues that you raised resolved in a less than 24-hour period of time. And as I had commented when I recognized you, we are talking about two pieces of legislation that are before the commission right now for review. And it sounds like your comments are a reiteration of the things from yesterday. And we did receive the things that you had provided us, and so I'm providing a little bit of latitude here today, even though you weren't speaking specifically on the two bills that were in front of us, because that's the matter that we're looking at. So if you had comments directly to the two bills, I'd like you to proceed. But if it's on the other topic from yesterday where we provided you some latitude to visit with the commission, and again a little bit today, I do acknowledge and have recognized that yesterday and once again today, but we aren't able to fix that on the spot for your request from yesterday to today. So, again, if you have comments to the two bills.
I would like to comment on the two bills. Once again, if the public is aware of this, but currently the bills that are online are not fully accessible. Adobe Reader, which accesses these documents, will not read struck through an underlying language. And for me to be engaged alone, the blind and visually impaired, it's hard for me to comment on a bill that isn't made compliance according to the American Disability Act. And I think we want a level playing field for those individuals to not only access them online in a way that they can actually load and be accessible for the public, but currently they are not. And I would say, based on rules, I would suggest that if you made the bar higher in this policy committee, because the LCC apparently isn't stepping up to this, the Legislation Coordinating Commission is not making these documents fully accessible to the public, you could move the bar up higher again by making sure that electronic documents are fully accessible for the public, including the older people that are visually impaired, blind, or perhaps are non-readers or English language learners. So I guess at this point I cannot frankly speak on a bill that's not appropriately accessible for the public.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Is there anyone else that would like to provide a comment to the commission? Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, in regard to Mr. Heller's comments, once these bills are introduced, then they are going to be available in your format, Mr. Heller. I'm reading the memo that Jason Kenley, with whom you and I worked last year, and he states in there that once the bills are introduced, the public website does allow for the screen reader function. So, that should be some kind of comfort for you, that once they're introduced, they'll be available.
If I may yield to that,
sir,
for one moment.
Again, I've provided an extremely large amount of latitude over 2 days for you on this. Everybody is recognizing where we're at on the process. And if you don't have comments specifically to the bills, you've made it abundantly clear that your preference is to have alternate formats, and the commission has recognized that. But us talking about it today isn't going to change that in the immediate context of this meeting. And again, I think I've been fairly generous in allowing you the opportunity to share your comments. And so if there aren't any other comments that are relative to this bill, I'm going to ask if there's others and then move on with the business of the commission, sir.
Thank you, and I hope that the LCC can make these documents fully accessible in the future, especially this document, because it is relevant to the whole process of the legislature regarding transparency and accessibility. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a quorum now on the Senate side. So do you want to entertain motions to approve the MSRS admin bill and the PER admin bill, or the motion is that they be incorporated into the omnibus pension bill?
Senator Pappas, I am just moments away from doing that. I just want to make sure that we don't have any other public testimony on the two bills.
Okay, I didn't see anyone jump.
And then, but I just want to double check to make sure that we don't have any questions or issues. Again, anyone wishing to testify on the MSRS or PERA corrections bill? Seeing none or hearing none, as Senator Pappas has pointed out, we do have a quorum, and so there are three items that the commission can take action on. There will be two other items hopefully we'll be able to take action on a little bit later this morning as well. The first item is, and I'm going to start with our conversation from yesterday, which is really old business and some housekeeping, and that is under item number 2, the LCPR 16-021. And I'm going to ask Ms. Lincheski to just brief the commission again our status and where we're at with this so that everyone is aware of what we're looking at here. Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, the primary reason for the bill is to change the interest rate assumption as it applies to the teacher's retirement fund from 8.5 to 8. And I believe that appears in, subdivision 8, paragraph A. So on page 2.
What's the bill number?
2.4. LCPR 16-021. Line 2.4 on page 2 is where we have the change to the teacher's retirement plan interest rate assumption from 8.5 to 8, which brings it into conformity with the other plans. The other plans changed their assumption last year. So those are not in this bill, but just the TRA change. In addition, since we had the opportunity here to put this in front of the commission, we are also making conforming changes. So the salary increase assumption over on, page 5, as well as the payroll growth assumption that appears on page 6, those changes actually have been approved by the motion that was approved yesterday. But we are now incorporating this into the statute so that the statute will be in line with what the commission has approved. And then the final changes to this subdivision 8 are housekeeping changes to remove obsolete language. So these references to select and ultimate interest rate assumptions, those could come out, so that those are taken out, as well as a reference to the local government correctional service retirement plan, which appears over in line 3.2 and 3.3. So those references are all obsolete. We have reviewed these closely again with the plans, and they have also reviewed them with their actuaries. So we feel pretty confident that the numbers as they appear now are consistent with the assumptions that will be used by the plans in their actuarial valuations.
Senator Pappas, did you want to move that?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I'll withdraw my previous motion, so we'll back up and move that LCPR 16-021 be recommended to be incorporated into the omnibus bill.
Oh, 1-2, I believe. You said 2-1. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm in the wrong spot. Sorry. Senator Pappas moves that LCPR 16-021 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the 2016 omnibus pension bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. And we have the two bills that we have just had presentations on that we'd like to move, and then we will bring up TRA and St. Paul teachers and take action on those as well. Again, we had presentations from both of those plan directors and their accompanying testifiers. And with that, is there a motion to move LCPR 16-001, the MSRS Administrative Provisions Correction Bill?
So moved. That's my previous motion.
Senator Pappas moves that LCPR 16-001 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the 2016 pensions bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And the next one to get us up to speed and up to real time would be the PERA, Administrative Provisions Bill, which is LCPR 16-003.
So moved.
Senator Pappas moves that LCPR 16-003 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the 2016 Omnibus Pension Bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed. We are now back on our agenda with the TRA provision. So we'll have Mr. Stoffel come forward, and he will give us a chance to visit and talk to us about the TRA corrections that we're looking at. Mr. Stoffel, welcome to the commission once again. And if you'll introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. My name is Jay Stoffel. I am the Deputy Executive Director of the TRA. And I will go through the sections briefly on LCPR 16-002, TRA Administrative Bill. Section 1 on page 1 relates to some definitional terms, definition of teacher. We're striking a couple of references to Duluth Public Schools since merger has occurred. We no longer need those references. They were missed during the cleanup from last year. And we also are deleting some obsolete language relating to including some language to clarify that in charter schools we're including charter school directors and chief administrative officers. We have had that as a policy since 2010 to cover those folks. Those positions are similar to superintendents in public schools, and so we're clarifying the language in the statute to make it clear that those positions should be covered by TRA. Page 2 is additional clarification in our definition of teacher to exclude, I'm on line 2.22, some obsolete language related to part-time positions at the Minsky faculty, staff positions. Those all relate to part-time people. And on page 3 at the very top, there's some additional language we're striking out, reference to Duluth Public Schools. Section 2 on page 2, in the first part, line 3.6, we're adding a definition for former spouse. We use that term throughout in various sections of the statute, so we wanted to have a definition of former spouse. Next, section 3 on page 3. This relates to expanding the candidate pool for the executive director position at TRA. Currently, the language specifies that the person needs 5 years of experience of administering a major retirement system. We're striking that and just having 5 years in either an executive level management position or other types of similar positions, so expanding the pool of candidates that could qualify. Section 4, beginning on page 3 and on page 4, is a section that adds the deputy executive director to the board authority for hiring positions within TRA. Currently, that authority isn't explicit, and it was suggested by MMB that we include this language to make it explicit in our statute. Section 5, at the bottom of page 5, has a change to our medical leave of absence. We're expanding medical leave to go from a one-year term to a five-year term. And practically, that's currently happening in many school districts. They grant a medical leave for several one-year periods, so it just would be more in line with what's happening that we expand that to a five-year term. And then there's at the bottom of page 5 and onto page 6, there's a section that relates to people who may be required by insurance companies to apply for long-term disability insurance. And that conflicts with the teacher's right to purchase service credit in the TRA while they're on medical leave. So the idea here is that if we receive an application for disability benefits, and if that application is received by TRA solely because it's being required by the insurance company, then we would have the authority to work with the member to really reject that application, unless the member really wants it to go forward for other reasons. But if it's solely because that the LTD company is requiring it, we would have the authority to reject that application and preserve that person's right to purchase service credit while they're on medical leave. If the person were to apply for disability benefit, they would lose the right. They would actually be applying for a benefit and thereby hopefully receiving the benefit and therefore not able to purchase service credit, which is maybe in many cases really what they'd rather do. So that's the reason for that change. Section 6 on page 6 is clarification of a former teacher who comes back to work must work at least currently 85 days. We're putting it in terms of a half a year. We determine service credit now based on, it's not based on the number of days. That's our older method of calculating service credit. It was based on a number of days. So we're striking any reference to number of days and putting it in terms of half a year to be consistent with the rest of the way we operate and calculate service credit. So a very technical change just relating to how many days it is required or what portion of year is required for a person to be entitled to the benefits that have been passed in law since they've left service and now have come back.
Mr. Stoffel, we do have a member question. Representative Kreshaw.
Just, Mr. Stoffel, thank you. One quick question. Is that half a calendar year or half a school year?
Half a calendar year.
Okay. So you're increasing the days from 85 to half of 365.
Right.
Okay.
Stoffel, yes, proceed.
Section 7 on page 6 is a part of the law that where we have people who in a divorce decree would select a life in term certain for that ex-spouse, and we currently have a 15-year term certain, so that protects benefits for the ex-spouse for a certain period of time. It's for a 15-year duration, and what this section does is it indicates that if the ex-spouse were to die within that 15-year period, then the payments continue that we're going to the former spouse, those payments continue to the beneficiaries of that former spouse or to the estate of that former spouse. That makes that section clear. So that created some ambiguity, and again, we're clarifying what occurs in that kind of a situation. So there's no ambiguity. Section 8 relates to payments to beneficiaries. In some cases, there are multiple beneficiaries selected by a member, and we're putting this section of law allows us to go back 6 months retroactive payment to the time when an application for benefits arrives for each beneficiary, depending on how many there are and when they arrive. What I'm trying to say here is there could be multiple beneficiaries. And rather than hold all the payments until all the beneficiaries come in, we will take them as they arrive, and we can go back 6 months retro to when the member died to start the payments. Section 9 on page 7 relates to some disability benefit provisions. Currently, we require a person to be making $75 in salary to be eligible for collecting disability benefits. So we're removing that requirement, and we're adding some language to define when that person must, who has not reached normal retirement age, is eligible for disability benefits. Section 10 of the bill removes a 60-day notification period. Currently, we've got a 14-day period where employers have a 14-day period to get information to us on payroll reporting. And then there's a requirement that we have to wait another 60 days at times before we can certify late payments to the Commissioner of Management and Budget. And there are times, especially in the cases of charter schools possibly, that we know that might be in a difficult situation, and forcing us to wait 60 days might be a little problematic in that we are not able to go and collect some overdue payments until a 60-day waiting period goes by. In the meantime, the situation may be deteriorating even more. So we're removing the 60-day period. The 14-day period that we currently have remains, but the 60-day period would be deleted with this change. Section 11 at the bottom of page 7 really clarifies, we're pointing out a clause in subsection 4D to identify that if a school reports late to us their annual base salary, then penalties would apply. There's another part of that section that we don't really want penalties to apply. It relates to reporting of the school calendar. We don't necessarily need school calendar information, and to have a penalty imposed on school districts on information that we don't need, that's currently the way the law reads. So we're just clearly just striking the provision that requires a penalty on information that we really don't need. So it leaves the penalty on the reporting of the annual salary information, which is critical for defining service credit. Section 12 on the next page, 8, is and the remainder of the bill really relates to some changes, some additions to we're making to Section 356 related to IRS compliance and how to proceed in cases when we've identified some overpayments or some noncompliance with IRS regulations. And much of this was developed with assistance from your staff, Ms. Lincheski, and we really appreciate the assistance she was able to provide. She's got a lot of experience in this area, and if it's okay, I'd just as soon turn it over to her to explain. We've sort of arranged this ahead of time to have her explain this part of the bill. But she was very, very helpful in coming up with the solution to this issue and has developed some very good workable language that will help us with the situation we have and some of the other funds. It will be broadly used by all the other funds in cases where there could be some issues.
Mr. Stoffel, you suggesting this would be a good time to do that because I think you've got only a couple of provisions left. We can do it either way. Pause right now and have a comment on this, or you can finish up and then we can circle back. What do you think is most appropriate in your presentation?
Well, I've concluded the parts that I'm prepared to explain. Okay. The rest would be related to the parts that we relied on with Susan Lincheski.
All right, Ms. Lincheski, if you want to share your thoughts on this portion, please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay, for the comments, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I prepared a staff memo here that goes through the provisions and reflects really what Jay has mentioned. Section 12 of the staff memo provides some detail on the background need to understand, I guess, in looking at sections 12 through 15 of the bill. The statute right now does address the Internal Revenue Code compliance, but there's another section of the statute that also did that. So part of what the bill does here is to take all those sections and combine them into one statutory section. And what now is in 356.635 subdivisions 9A through 12 are really the federal limits. So these are the limits that apply to the annual benefit that can be paid out of a defined benefit plan. They also govern the amount of contributions that can go into a defined contribution plan account, again, under the Internal Revenue Code. So those changes are all in Sections 12 through 15 of the bill. In addition, Section 16 also relates to Internal Revenue Code compliance, but is a slightly different topic, which is if a plan violates, for instance, the limits, or has some other operational defect, as the IRS likes to call these, just simply an error in administration, there is an IRS program that will kick in and allow the plans to correct the error and not have to fear that were the IRS to come in subsequently and audit the plan, they would find that the plan was, in fact, out of compliance and that what we have here is a disqualified plan. So Section 16 of the bill adds a section that explicitly provides that the plans can make use of the self-correction program when there is a need, when an operational error is found, and in addition can take corrective measures in accordance with the self-correction program that the IRS has. Those may include recouping payments or overpayments that were made to participants, members in this case. It may include other types of correction, such as transferring money, finding sources of funding to recoup overpayments, actions that the executive director needs to take in order to correct a problem. So that's what essentially we're doing here. Again, I think this brings the plan language, really the language that applies to all the plans, into closer compliance with what the federal law provides for.
Members' questions on the TRA administrator proposals? Seeing none from members, is there anyone from the public who would like to testify on the matter before the commission on the TRA, Teacher Retirement Association, administrative provisions? Seeing none and hearing none, let the record show there were none. Members,
do you want to take the motion now, Mr. Chairman?
Certainly.
Okay, then I would move that LCPR 16-002 be recommended to be incorporated into the omnibus bill.
Senator Pappas moves that LCPR 16-002 be recommended to pass and to be incorporated to the 2016 omnibus pension bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Members, we have our final presentation from St. Paul Teachers, and as Ms. Schertz is making her way to the testifying table, that'll be LCPR 16-004. Ms. Schertz, welcome, and if you'll introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jill Schertz. I'm the Executive Director of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. I also have with me today our Deputy Director, Christine McDonald. And what that means is if you ask me a very challenging question, I will immediately punt it to her.
So in other words, you brought your own phone a friend, I understand.
That's right.
All right.
That's right. Mr. Chairman, again, our bill is purely administrative and borders on fairly boring. We are simply seeking to clarify in five provisions the application of interest repayment. Last year, as a part of our legislative package, we proactively moved our investment return assumption from 8.5% to 8%. That also had some accompanying administrative changes. Our members under these five provisions are allowed to repay certain amounts, and on those repayments, interest is applied. The change we made last year simply clarified that for certain periods it would be 8.5% and certain it would be 8%. This year's change, we simply want to make sure there's no ambiguity, that if the period for which the member is making a repayment happens to fall in both of those periods, we will do a split calculation for the period of time. A member is making a repayment for the 8.5% when that was in effect. That's how we'll do the calculation. For any period of time in the post-8.5% regime, we'll do the calculation at 8%. So no fundamental change, just a clarification under those five applicable provisions. We'd be happy to take any questions.
Ms. McDonald, you might get off without having to testify today.
Absolutely.
questions for the testifiers? Members' questions? Members, I will ask if there's anyone from the public who would like to testify on the matter before the commission relative to Ms. Crockett, if you'd like to come forward, and that is LCPR 16-004. Ms. Crockett, welcome to the commission, and if you would state your name for the record and then provide your testimony.
Good morning. I'm Kim Crockett from Center of the American Experiment. I figured since I'm going to be here this morning, I hadn't planned any testimony, and I'm waiting for the summary to come out from staff that helps me do my analysis each year on the St. Paul Fund and the others. I just want to make a quick observation to you, and I will follow up with a report to all of you once I get summary from the staff, which I work off of. Just to say that while all this administrative work is very important, and I don't have any particular objection to how you tweak these defined benefit plans here in Minnesota, but my observation is that they really aren't in better shape than when I started hanging out with you 5 years ago. They're actually in worse shape. And last time I checked the total, it was a $17.6 billion number for all funds that the state is underfunded. I suspect that number has grown. I don't know what the total is yet. Maybe Ms. Lincheski can share that with you. And I suspect that after the returns in the stock market over the last year, with all the benefits that are being paid out to retirees who paid in duly all these years, that the funding ratio is probably less for the St. Paul Fund as well as the others, even though their executive directors are trying everything that they can think of to fix these. So years later, I think the problem still exists and that you need to seriously consider moving new employees into defined contribution plans to stop the digging, and then figure out how you keep the promise to all of the employees, again, who have duly paid into these and are relying on you for a secure retirement. That's all I have to say this morning.
Ms. Crockett, thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Is there anyone else who would like to share comments or thoughts from the public to the commission at this time?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one thought is we have a lot of new members on the commission that perhaps there was a study done about transferring our plans to defined contribution. And as I recall, the transition costs were quite high. And how we would handle that is, you know, still an open question, that maybe we should dig out that study of a couple years ago and review it again for commission members. So I don't think that that's a solution. I think our pension directors are working hard, as Ms. Crockett said, with sustainability plans that, you know, when the market goes down, everybody has to pay in more, both employer and employee, to keep the plan sustainable. And you know, I think the plan directors and the boards have come up with proposals. You know, it's controversial. It's more money for the school districts. It's going to be a problem for sure to face that. But it's something that this pension commission has always been willing to do, is make the hard choices and decisions.
Ms. Crockett.
The 2011 study that was presented to this commission has been shredded by several studies. I shared it with you last year and the year before. I'd be happy to bring that back to you. It's a debate that's been going on in the administration of public sector pension funds for years on how you make that transition, Senator Pappas, and what it costs. And it's called the myth of the transition costs. It's been handled in the literature. I do believe that Dave Bergstrom acknowledged some of those critiques that have been out there, and the Minnesota study was named specifically as being mistaken and debunked. And again, I'd be happy to share that information with you. Public sector pension funds are making that transition. It is a painful one. It's the most difficult thing, I think, politically, that legislators are faced with around the nation, but it's being done. And that study, I think, needs to probably be put on the shelf and stay there. And you need to look to the literature to see how these things are being done successfully, and not at the cost of billions, I do believe, that it mentioned. Now, I do think that if you made the decision to make that transition, it would be expensive. You've created a problem over 30 years, and it would probably take that long to pay it down. But I think that the state has the expertise and also the ethical obligation to do that.
Mr. Bergstrom, you were involved in there, and I think may want to just share some background and insight. So we'll certainly let you share your thoughts. Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Dave Bergstrom, the director of the State Retirement System, and I think according to the debate rules, I get 30 seconds. and I have not said what Ms. Crockett stated. I stand by
I'm so excited, I thought you did.
Mr. Crockett, let him continue.
I stand by the report we do. It is not a myth of the transition costs. There are ways to spin it. There are ways to do it, but they are very true, and I think if you want to have that debate at some point, I'd be happy to get involved in that. I choose not to do it today. I just wanted to clarify, because I was involved in that study. The legislature asked us to do the study, so I felt I had to come up and defend the study. You know, like any issue, there are you can look at it from different ways. But it is, if there are concerns when you close a plan, and just common sense says if you close a plan, you have fewer dollars coming in. Common sense says you're going to have to be more conservative with your investments. And there are just a lot of common sense arguments that these reports do. And there are a lot of think tanks and people who come with ideas, but when you get into the bottom line, it becomes money. And I just wanted to come up and defend the report.
Spurgeon, thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm a little confused. Number one, can you remind me who did the study back in 2011? Senator Pappas and I were both on that.
Senator Pappas, do you recall who the author of the study was?
Mr. Chair, it was the chair at the time, Representative Smith, requested it be put in law. They instructed the pension plans to do the study.
Right.
We had an actuary look at that. We had an actuary that was hired. They have many standards. We did it in accordance with the pension commission standards that you have adopted. And that's the standard we followed. So we put it together, and I would say clearly in that report, we tried to be as open and honest. We also tried to deflect some of the attacks and critics that, come after us because, you always hear one side and there's a side to other things as well. So. Mm-hmm.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. I too do remember that study very well. And I guess I would like to know, Ms. Crockett, who is shredding it? What groups? Hold on. Yeah. And then I'd also just like to make a comment. I do believe that there was very high expense, billions, of switching over the transition to DC, defined contribution. So we're talking about new employees versus switching the entire system over. So I think there's a lot of misinformation or miscommunication here around the table, and I do too stand by that report. I thought it was very well done, and I think actuarially sound, and I think our plans did a good job. So I would like to know who is shredding it, Ms. Crockett.
Ms. Crockett.
Sure. There's a pension expert. I think he's also an actuarial named Robert Costrell with the Manhattan Institute. Another one is Josh McGee. He came here and testified, I believe, in 2014, who's also a pension expert. I'd be happy to get you a list of the people who have gone after that study in particular and suggest to you that there are experts outside of the people who administer the funds who would be subject to closing that you might wish to turn to. And I'd be happy to put you in touch with, for example, Robert Costrell, whom I'm thinking of in particular, to make suggestions in that regard should you be moving in that direction. But the analysis that was done was really quite devastating. And I would recommend to you that you look at that analysis before you put your confidence in that report and consider looking elsewhere for information on that transition period. This is the public sector management has moved light years since Representative Manning was chair, and that whole discussion was taking place in that post 2008 crisis mode after the 2010 legislation. A lot has happened. Pensions have been the subject of great scrutiny and study all over the nation. And the United States problem is sort of unique to our country. Public pension funds aren't run the way they are here in the U.S. They're different in the U.K., even South America, and other places. So there's a lot available to you as resources, and I'd be happy to help bring some of those to the commission.
Members, I'm getting hands coming left and right on here. And the last time I checked, the business that was before the commission was an administrative corrections bill. And I have allowed a little bit of deviation from that. The conversation that we had yesterday and is probably more in keeping with the comments that we have today, and we'll certainly be talking more about those. What I'd like to do is give Representative Albright and Senator Hayden each an opportunity to share some thoughts, and then I would like to just move forward at that point before the bill, because we are not the first days of the discussion for 2016, or I should say the last days were much closer to the first days of those discussions and what lies ahead of this commission and our work. So with that, Representative Albright, if you would be succinct with your comments, and Senator Hayden, you are at the floor next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, and I'll only just ask for clarification with regard to the study that seems to be bandied about, and I've not read it, and so I'll admit that. But with regard to the study, if you can recall, was the determination within the study for a closure of pensions as opposed to what some in the industry call a freezing of the pension with new participants rolling into a defined contribution type of arrangement?
Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, the study assumed no new members would come into the plan as of a specific date.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
I'm just wondering for a point of benefit to those that are new to the committee, if that study would be provided to us as well.
I think that the general assumption was that that paperwork still exists, and whoever would like to have it could, and review with who the appropriate experts would be. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be really brief. I just want to caution the commission and the testifiers as we kind of start to figure this out. I take some exception to the kind of cavalier nature of this conversation that we just bandy about things like shredded or myths or saying that members of the plans said something that they did or didn't do. And I know that that's a little far from what we are, but this is pretty serious stuff. And I just want us to really, if we come forward, in particular, Ms. Crockett, with a set of ideas, then we have to be really clear. We have to be able to show, not kind of off from your memory, but say, here's why, and here are the experts, and here is their background, and this is why we think that the work that we're doing, or this is why my position is such. I got a little uncomfortable with just almost the casual nature and then some of the integrity kind of insinuations in this conversation. This is, as we all know, really, really, really important to a lot of people. And the advice that we get from you and others that are experts, I know as a new member, is really important for me to know. But I do want it to be something that I feel like I can trust and not something that is almost casual in nature. So I would just hope as we move forward and we get into the longer debate about what we should do, that especially the experts in the committee that I depend on, that we really come and we're really clear about what we're talking about, and that we're really clear about who those experts are and why they made the decision and what makes them experts. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. And with that, I'm going to return to, if there are other questions on the bill, the matter before the commission, which is LCPR 16-04, the St. Paul Teacher Pension Retirement Administrative Provisions. Seeing no one rushing down. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Sackhoff.
Chair, move the bill.
All right, Senator Saxhog moves that LCPR 16-04 be recommended to pass and be incorporated in the 2016 pensions bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed. Thank you, members. We have one other item, and I'm going to defer that to Ms. Lincheski. That's under item 5, other business, and a little bit of an update on something that Senator Thompson had brought before the commission, who was not able to be here. But since this is a commission meeting and it's an update, I wanted to visit, have the opportunity for members to hear a little bit about this, and just defer to Ms. Lincheski a little bit on some of what she's heard and some of possible courses of action that we might be looking to take. So, Ms. Lincheski, if you would be so kind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Rachel Barth is all ready to talk on this issue, if that's all right.
Excellent. I like it when we tear up like that. Ms. Barth, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we've reached out to EPOC, which is the group of the gentlemen who came into the presentation, since our last update in November, and we have not received any further response or information from them. So we are now proceeding and looking into what the process would be to implement a similar sort of life insurance program in the plans. And we're sort of reaching out now as our initial phase to different agencies like SBI to sort of get their input, and looking at the plan statutes to see what revisions would be necessary to implement such a program, and any other additional types of funding like gifts or bequeathments that the commission would be interested in also implementing. So really just kind of looking at the first steps that would be needed to take to start implementing such a program and getting input.
And members, one other thing I'll just mention on this, the language that Senator Thompson had brought forward, because it says right now that TRA is only allowed to accept money into the fund from two different sources, employee deductions and employer contributions, and it's pretty prescriptive as to where those sources are. And one of the things that Senator Thompson was looking at is expanding that to, say, proceeds from a life insurance policy or other kinds of things. And in my consultation with staff and some other folks, it was like if you had a teacher who was really committed, let's say, to the cause of education and wanted to make sure that teachers received a pension, they died. And in their will, they said they wanted that money to go in to help shore up TRA. There's no way the state could literally legally take that money because it's not from an employee deduction or from a contribution from an employing entity, or someone who had a life insurance policy and said $50,000 of this benefit is to go to a pension plan because they felt so strongly about that. The state is not in a position to be able to accept those funds. And so it might be worth looking at some enabling legislation to allow something like that, and also to be able to provide a little bit more opportunity for other venues if that becomes appropriate, or other options, they said, in this venue, if it becomes appropriate for us to do that. So I wanted to just touch in with the members again in the absence of Senator Thompson, and he and I did speak, that we would be kind of updating the commission at this point. Are we still wanting to move forward, and should we ask staff to look at some drafting of some language that would allow for that to happen that could be included in our omnibus bill? No commitments that we move forward, but some enabling legislation to allow for maybe the things I talked about and the idea of what we'll call the EPOC idea. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, what was requested from the EPOC group that you have not received any information from?
I don't have that information firsthand, but I bet Ms. Barth or Ms. Lincheski could give us a little bit more background.
I also don't have the list currently. I went through it. I apologize at the last November meeting, but it was just a lot more of sort of details about the structure of these trusts that they spoke to us about and kind of how the money would move between those trusts and where the plan would fit in with having any sort of control over how the money moves and where it goes and who is the third party that's really handling the money. And we wanted a lot more details on that because we felt the presentation was a little vague on those, and we needed to kind of get a little bit more input from other entities like SBI and whether or not they could accept funds from life insurance proceeds and such. So that's kind of the questions we were looking into.
Ms. Lincheski, do you have some background for the commission as well to Senator Rosen's question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rosen, I spent some time on the phone with them going through the materials that they had provided to us, and there seemed to be some admission that the materials were not really appropriate for a public pension plan like this. It was really directed at hospitals and that sort of thing. So as we dug into this, asking more questions and actually went through their legal memo that they had and pointed out some holes that really didn't apply in our situation, there was a discussion that maybe we should just sort of put this on hold until they at least do the program in some jurisdiction, because at this point they have not yet done, you know, put one of these in. So at that point, things sort of were put on hold. They were able to provide us at any time. We were very open to taking anything else that they had, but we have not received anything further from the EPOC gentlemen.
So if members are not opposed, or we would direct Ms. Lincheski and Ms. Barth to put some possible language together for inclusion and for us to look at a future point in time, I don't see or hear any objections to just moving forward on that. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was not in attendance at the presentation by EPIC, but my background and just the antenna went up when we start talking about the language of an estate making a gift back into a qualified plan, even of a public nature, and, you know, such terms as insurable interest and the qualified nature, as we've dealt with the voluntary corrective measures in the last proposal. And so I would urge this commission to go forward with a great caution, and given the nature of the estate law as compared to with ERISA, even though we are not privy or required to abide by it, I think it does provide for a roadmap of least peril with talking about these. And so while I'm not opposed to consideration of the topic, while I'm not opposed to looking at enabling language, I think the word enabling in and of itself, I think, speaks to a greater concern that I have for this. We take our jobs very, very seriously here, and I truly appreciated the comments made by Senator Hayden with regard to the severity and the consequence that we make determination around this table for the lives of the people that we realize and are needful of jurisprudence with regard to our deliberations. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I would just, as a member of this commission, urge great caution at our peril for those we serve with these pensions when talking about this subject.
Thank you, Representative Albright. There is no other business before the commission. Seeing none and hearing none, we are adjourned. Thank you, members.
Mr. Chair, all right. Yep. Not in December.
My son is in Fairbanks, so.
Not in December. December and January are very sleepy months.
It'll get better now.
It's been getting better. It's, you know, it's of course I wasn't home.
Yeah, I mean, you don't feel.
Oh, we know.